Welcome. And I'm Rick Barton. I'm the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project with Karen Von Hippel. And on behalf of our team, Shannon Hayden back here, Mark Irvin, Vanessa Kulik, who was greeting you outside, and others, we're pleased to have you here today for what we think is going to be a terrific discussion. As you know from our report, Perilous Course, that Craig Cohen, who's also here today, authored, we put a tremendous emphasis on the rule of law and the activism of the Pakistani bar and of the lawyers in Pakistan has really been one of the most encouraging events of the last year. And so we're really pleased to have a couple of the leaders of the movement with us today. I'd like to thank Ryan Hancock as well from the Pakistan Justice Coalition for helping us to arrange this event, and Malaka Sandini, who's been offering her wise counsel to our project as well. I've asked each of the speakers today to give us about 10 to 12 minutes of their opinions and their personal experiences. I think they've agreed to that time limitation, so if you see me get frisky at the 15-minute mark, you'll know that, like most speakers, there's always a gap between promise and performance, but I think we'll be able to do that, so we'll have lots of time for our question and answer discussion with this very good audience. Our first speaker today is Anwar Hamid, who is a senior advocate of the Supreme Court, and he previously served as the secretary of the Supreme Court Bar Association of Pakistan. He was serving as the vice president of the Supreme Court Bar Association when President Musharraf placed Chief Justice Chaudhry on inactive status on March 9th of last year. And after the declaration of emergency rule, Mr. Hamid was arrested at his home and held in detention for 15 days. And he will really give us, talk to us about his personal experience. Our other speaker is Hamid Khan, who's a distinguished legal scholar, Supreme Court lawyer, and former president of the Pakistan Supreme Court Bar Association. He's a senior vice president, number two of the political party Pakistan Movement for Justice that Imran Khan heads. He was a member of the defense team that successfully advocated for Chief Justice Chaudhry's reinstatement in July of last year. He also argued the case against President Musharraf, contesting his eligibility to stand for the presidential elections that precipitated the November 3rd emergency, and he's a known constitutional scholar. So he will talk more about the evolution of the constitutional law issues in Pakistan and also about some of the political implications, but clearly they're ready to have a broader discussion with you as well. I think both speakers would like to speak from the podium, and Anwar Hamid, if you would please go first. Thank you all for coming.
Mr. Rick Barton, Mr. Hamid Khan, respected ladies and gentlemen, it's a matter of great honor and pleasure for me to address this distinguished gathering of American elite. Let me tell you that year 2007 is a very crucial year in the history of Pakistan. I was the vice president of the Supreme Court Bar Association Pakistan during this period. On 9th of March 2007, while I was at Islamabad, I had a meeting with the Chief Justice at 2 p.m. When I went to the Supreme Court building, in front of the Supreme Court building, there was a large and heavy contingent of police deployed, and they didn't allow me to enter into the Supreme Court building. I asked them, what is the reason? They said the Chief Justice has been removed by the President and has been made dysfunctional. Till such time, a new Chief Justice takes oath. You cannot be allowed to enter into the Supreme Court building. I was really perturbed at that moment of time. I discussed with other political leaders of the bar and gave a call to all the lawyers of Pakistan to agitate against this unconstitutional act of the government. Resultantly, lawyers throughout Pakistan started agitation. They took out processions. They held meetings in this respect because ever since the Pakistan came into being, throughout it was our effort to get the judiciary independent from the executive. We have always been calling it as a B team of the government. But when Justice Iftikhar Muhammad Chaudhry started taking independent decisions, So we appreciated and backed him in the, in his efforts to make the judiciary independent. With the efforts of the lawyers community, which stood like a rock against the unconstitutional act of the president, the judges of the Supreme Court, before whom the question of reference of the Chief Justice was pending, ultimately declared the reference unconstitutional, and the Chief Justice was restored. Again, feeling encouraged that the judiciary has taken a step forward towards its independence, the question of eligibility of General Musharraf to contest the election was ultimately brought before the Supreme Court of Pakistan, and Mr. Hamid Khan was pursuing that case in the Supreme Court. According to our constitution, a person who is in the civil service of Pakistan, he is not entitled to and eligible to be a candidate for president of Islamic Republic of Pakistan unless he retires or resigns and 2 years have passed by. Since he was the chief of army staff, therefore, according to the constitution of Pakistan, 1973, he was not eligible. When the government learned that the decision of his eligibility would be against General Musharraf, on 3rd of November, 1973, General Musharraf, acting as chief executive, chief of army staff, suspended the constitution of Pakistan, promulgated provisional constitution order, and also enforced emergency in the country, stating therein that since constitution of Pakistan does not cater to such problems, therefore, he is imposing this emergency as chief of army staff, thereby suspending the complete fundamental rights of the people. On that very day, 70% judges of the superior courts were restrained from acting. They were not only restrained, they were confined to their houses, detained in their houses. And not only that, our president, Mr. Ehtezaz Ehsan, was arrested along with some other office bearers on the evening of 3rd of November. On 4th of November, large number of lawyers, including me, was also arrested under maintenance of public order, 1960, alleging therein that I have been leading the processions, peaceful processions of, obviously, we the lawyers always believe in supremacy of rule of law. We never take the law in our own hands, but we have a fundamental right to demonstrate against any illegality. But the order, the officers who came to my residence at 11 p.m. midnight didn't have the orders with them. Only verbal orders were passed for my arrest and detention. So I was kept in detention for about 15 days. Likewise, many other lawyers and leaders of the bar were put to arrest on 5th of November 2007. While the lawyers were organizing an agitational meeting, were holding an agitational meeting, heavy contingent of police baton charged them and injured many lawyers. About 1,700 lawyers were arrested on that date, and they were put to different jails in Pakistan. You can see the plight of rule of law in Pakistan, that Chief Justice and 70 judges of the Superior Courts are asking for justice. So that was the plight, and our struggle in nutshell is that we want in our country strong democracy and democratic institutions. We want a strong judiciary to look into the excesses of the executive. We want the revival of Constitution 1973 to the position of 2nd of November, because certain amendments have been made through an ordinance which are absolutely unconstitutional, because Chief of our Army Staff has no power whatsoever to amend the Constitution. It is only by 2/3 majority of the National Assembly and Senate that the amendment can be made in the Constitution. So our basic purpose of our struggle and agitation is that we should have strong democracy in the country, rule of law, independence of judiciary, and for a long-lasting democracy, independence of judiciary is a foremost thing. Without independence of judiciary, you cannot ensure the democracy and the democratic institutions to run, because then there will always be excesses from the executive, or there's a possibility that any other military ruler may not take it over. So we, the people of Pakistan and the lawyers, think that the US policy should be more friendly towards the people of Pakistan, and not for the, it should not favor the military dictator, it should favor the people of Pakistan. And that is how we can be a good ally for fighting terrorism, because the association of people of Pakistan, who are absolutely innocent, and they are the ones, you can see the elections, they are not fundamentalists, as has been painted here. See, look at the results of the election. Only 3 seats the fundamental parties or the religious parties could fetch in these elections. So to have a strong relationship with the people of Pakistan, we want that Jewish people should prevail upon US government to support the cause of people of Pakistan and not of the cause of any dictator. Thank you.
Mr. Iqbatan, Mr. Anwar Hamid, and the distinguished gathering here, it's my privilege to speak to you at this occasion. I will be taking up the matter with regard to some of the things which are today seem to be the part of the foreign policy of the United States towards Pakistan, and some of the premises which around which it appears to us that for the last 8 years, and particularly recently, this foreign policy is built around. And we want to show that the flaws that have come up in this policy, which has virtually estranged the people of Pakistan due to the conduct of such foreign policy. So as you'll see, that what happened on the 3rd of November, as Mr. Hamid explained to you, was something which was totally outrageous. You don't find any parallel in the history of the world where you suspending the constitution, you virtually physically, forcibly throw out the judges and prevent giving them a verdict on a question of eligibility of someone to run for an election. So this was the most outrageous thing that that even a dictator can do to its own judiciary. So now where we stand, he has then immediately moved under the emergency to hold an election. However, the elections could not be held according to his own desire, for the reason that we lost, or rather our one of the foremost political leader was assassinated during the course of the election campaign. And the results that we see on the 18th of February are not the results that Musharraf wanted to have. But let me just warn that these results are not, again, the correct results. There has been a large-scale rigging of these elections. There have been pre-poll rigging. There have been change in the results. There have been miscounting, manipulations that have taken place. And you will have many international reports that have reported on the tactics used. But to be, just 4 factors, I must say, which are very clear, which shows that there was no environment available for free and fair election. There was no independent judiciary, as you know. The election commission was not independent. There was a toady sitting there as a chief election commissioner. There was no free media available, because prior to, but particularly on 3rd of November, Musharraf imposed great constraints and restraints on the free media. So therefore, the opposition did not have an even playing field. They could not put their point of view across through the media in Pakistan. So that was the third ingredient which was missing. And the fourth, to have a neutral government to hold the elections. On the other hand, the elections, the governments that were appointed by Musharraf were consist of all his cronies for the last 4 years. So there was no neutral government. Actually, Musharraf continued to be run the government. The previous chief ministers and were there to run their provincial governments. These were only a smoke screen. These Johnnies who were shown to be chief ministers and prime ministers actually were exercising no power. So therefore, this was the environment in which this election took place. And even then, the election came out with a result. The result was that those parties who were in opposition for the last 8 years, they came out triumphant. His political party, despite all his efforts, did not get more than 14% of the seats. That also was achieved through miscounting, manipulation, changing the results. Wherever the race was close, Q League, his own party's candidate, won. So that is how, even then, he could not achieve more than 14%. Then it was, he had promised that in case his party loses, he will step down. But just the, after, there was a rumor, strong rumor, he had given an interview to a British a newspaper that he will step down, since he has lost. But what made him change his mind is mysterious, but we can understand and speculate about it. So what is really disturbing us, why we are here with you, and what we want to put across is that we have lived with a terrible, a tyrant, and a military dictator who seemed to have been a favorite of Bush administration for the last 8 years, for the last at least 7 years, because after 9/11, and that we feel, we have a perception, a strong one, that he is backed by Bush administration, even now. Even when he has lost his political game, he is no longer being, people have rejected him in big number, even then he is being backed by the Bush administration. And what do we have as evidence? As outsiders, we have an evidence that Mr. Boucher, Assistant Secretary of State, made a very clear statement, appeared in our media, that we recognize him as the president. Whereas our position is that even the question of his being eligible to run for the office of president is still under question. And that order has to, that has to be decided. Then Mr. Negroponte, he has said so. And Madam Rice has also said very clearly that we want to do business with him. Why don't you do business with him? When we are happy with you, the people of Pakistan should also be happy with him. So these are very clear statements, policy statements on behalf of the Bush administration that make us feel that that an undesirable dictator is being thrust upon us. Now I wanted to clear in the light of this that there is something which we need to keep in mind, that the real longevity and stability of our relationship between the between Pakistan and the United States depends more on democracy rather than one man or a dictatorship in Pakistan. Because eventually it will be the restoration of constitution, restoration of the judiciary that will make judiciary that will make democracy functional in Pakistan. And certainly that will endear if U.S. administration stand by democracy in Pakistan, try to promote the democratic institutions, and you know that democracy is one of the prime democratic institutions in the country. If they are backed, our demand is backed by the U.S. administration, I think they will be able to win hearts and minds of the people. And the evidence is the parties who have made it as part of the election agenda, the second most successful party had sole one-point agenda, restoration of judiciary, and how the people voted for them. Despite the fact that a number of parties have boycotted, including my party, on this very question, so this is the most important issue around, for which we need backing rather than adversity on this issue. And so far we have perceived that the U.S. administration is not backing our demand or backing our stand for the restoration of judiciary, which is a pillar of the democracy. And I think it in the long run, it is something which will promote better relationship with the people of Pakistan, because people of Pakistan rejects Musharraf. So therefore, it is, we perceive that the best course available is the restoration of democracy, and whatever restoration of judiciary, they will take care of many issues which are unnecessarily being debated publicly now and politically. We can make it non-political by letting the judiciary decide on the touchstone of the Constitution. The question next is, that's a matter of security for the United States. We are fighting war on terror. He's a partner in war on terror. Let me dispel this impression. If at all, Musharraf's role is that he's a liability on war on terror. He has stitched together the war on terror with his political power. So he thinks his perpetuation power depends upon the recurrence of incidents in the war on power. He will contrive some of them. And I must admit, one of them, like Red Mosque thing, is his own creation, if not creation, perpetuation. Because this matter could have been resolved in the very first month by a low-level official of the government. A few women went into a library next door and took illegal possession of it. A few police women could have easily driven them out from that illegal possession, and things might have been nipped at that time. They let this thing happen. They let arms go into that mosque. They let the extremists go into the mosque. They let a situation develop where some of those extremists therein got weaponry to challenge the state. This is what he wanted to prove. There was ISI, our chief intelligence agency, sitting next door to the Red Mosque. They were blind to what was happening. And they created a situation where a large military operation had to take place, and he wanted to take credit. See, he resolves the problems of terror. He first creates terror and then tries to resolve it at a big cost, both to the people over there and to the armed forces itself. So therefore, this game should be understood, that he is not the one who's a bulwark against terrorism. He's the one who perpetrates terrorism and tries to justify his continuation power on that basis. So it must also be appreciated that he has no mandate. He has not been elected as president. Why the State Department wants to tell us that we should accept him as the president when we know that he's not even qualified to run for the office of president? So therefore, standing by a dictator who's unpopular, hated, has no mandate, actually achieves the opposite results to what is desired now. So therefore, I believe there are many ways forward. I don't want to take more time, because let's have more question and answer on this question. On this, I have, I think, 3 to 4 minutes, I believe. The answer is to address the people of Pakistan rather than a dictator and head of the military, or the military leadership. Our purpose, the lawyers' movement, the political parties' movement, is to separate political power from war on terrorism. That is a different matter altogether. Let political power not be dependent upon someone who is perceived as one fighting war on terror. So therefore, these three things should be separated. Let the political power be taken by those whom people elect in a free and fair elections. They will take care of it. Nothing to fear. I don't know why Bush administration fears that if there is somebody else, there will be a vacuum. If Musharraf goes, I think he's so indispensable, something horrible will happen. I can assure you, something good will happen. And as long as he's there, horrible things keep happening. Because he must have those horrible things happen in order to justify himself for his own perpetuation. So that should be made clear. And we have constitutional processes to replace him. They're very simple. Today he resigns. The chairman of the Senate will take over as acting president. And within 30 days under the Constitution, new election will take place of the president. And then another thing which I want to make clear. He has no business to hold executive power under our Constitution. we are not a presidential form of government. There seems to be some misperception here that he is very essential or indispensable because when he holds the executive power, we feel comfortable with him. At least we know our man is there. He has no business to hold executive power. He, at best, can be a president in a system, in a parliamentary setup, where presidents are only figureheads. It is the prime minister, it is the parliament, it is the cabinet that holds the executive power. This is what we want to do. We want a system of, we have a system of parliamentary system. He is the one who is tampering with it by holding on to the executive power, virtually destroying, mutilating our constitution. That should not be done. We want, you should better deal with our prime ministers who represent the people of Pakistan. You better deal with our parliaments rather than dealing with one man and his coterie of journals. So that is what is, and the perception in Pakistan is that the Bush administration rather wants to deal with one man or few of his henchmen rather than with the democratic mess that is created by naturally by elections and by formation of governments in a parliamentary setup. And therefore, he thinks that he should hold the power, in his absence there will be a vacuum. He says that he is occupying the wrong space in our politics. He is taking over the functions of the prime minister, the parliament, so and so, all to himself. This is something which is most undesirable in any political party system, in any parliamentary system. So that is what I wanted to make. Okay, we have constitutional processes to cure any situation of his absence. That will be a good riddance and will be beginning of new understanding between the two countries on the principles of democracy. And last thing which I would like to say, that aid that has been given to Pakistan for the last many years have been heavily used, rather than more than 90% for military purposes. The people of Pakistan got nothing out of it. The money that gets goes to the journals, they spend it, nobody asks, they don't become part of Pakistan's budget. Is not spent under any kind of system of accountability. The result is people of Pakistan perceive that there is a relationship of the principal and agent between the Bush administration and our military junta. They pay for the services, they provide them services. People of Pakistan are not part of it. They are out extraneous to that, and therefore this is, instead of winning the hearts and minds of the people of Pakistan, are creating a situation there where feel strongly against the policy of the Bush administration. So therefore, concluding, I would say that whatever are the demands of the right-thinking political parties as well as the lawyers' movement, I think that needs to be supported on the touchstone of democracy, in which avowedly the all American administration has said that they are committed. Please get them committed to our cause of democracy and independence of judiciary and strong parliament. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you both very much for your remarks. I think let me ask the first question. Then we have when it looks like we've got a number of questioners. If you guys can just pick your way through, why don't I just ask the first one and then just come on down and please identify yourself as you do ask the question, and if you could keep your question to a minute, that would be great. I think that you told us rather clearly what would the procedure should Musharraf leave office. But the question that we have is the parliament going to move on Musharraf first or on restoring the judges? And what are the avenues that are available to the parliament to restore the judges? How much authority do they have on this matter?
Thank you. Actually, the issue of the judges is not a political issue as we see it. We see it as a constitutional issue. Naturally, every constitutional issues have its political implications. In our view, the act of Musharraf on 3rd of November was completely unconstitutional and invalid and should be ignored and should be done away with, the earliest the better, and the judges whom he imprisoned, whom he deposed, should be brought back. It doesn't need any constitutional amendment to do so. which Musharraf keeps saying that if you want to undo my act, you bring in two-third majority. This nothing is more absurd than that. He has not been able to amend the constitution by one-man act. The constitution can only be amended by two-third majority of each house of the parliament. So therefore, he alone cannot fill in that gap. So therefore, at best, he has done some unconstitutional acts which needs to be undone. At the earliest, its effects should be completely dissolved. And so what needs to be done on the 3rd of November, when this was about to happen, on an application that we had filed a day earlier, because we were apprehending that there was something outrageous about to happen, something very unconstitutional is perceived, will be done by Musharraf to save his skin. He doesn't want a verdict against his candidacy. So we made an application saying that such and such things are possibly out of constitution, emergency may be imposed. He may have a provisional constitution order. He may force judges to take the oath under that. He may sack the judges on that pretext. Please declare that all such steps, if taken, would be completely unconstitutional, and restrain them, pass an injunction against taking any such acts. And that order was passed on the 3rd of November, when the Supreme Court was being encircled and by the armed forces. And they passed that order on that day, in which they declared all these steps as unconstitutional and restrained everyone to take oath under that unconstitutional instrument. And now that order is the last order of the Supreme Court, validly constituted Supreme Court in Pakistan, which needs to be implemented. And it is the constitutional obligation of every executive to act in aid and assistance of the orders of the Supreme Court and to implement the orders of the Supreme Court. All it needs to be done is pass an executive order in compliance with the order of the Supreme Court passed on 3rd of November, and the result would be that these judges will come back to work. All restraining, all force restraining them from doing their job will be taken out of the way, and they will come back to the job in the same capacity as they were on 2nd of November 2007 or 3rd of November, meaning that by restoring the status quo ante. They only have to provide sufficient force to undo the force which has restrained them from performing their function. This is simple executive act which will cure the matter, no question of having any debate in the under the constitution, because as you will appreciate.
But let me make sure, I'm not quite sure that I'm clear. It's a simple executive order, but who takes the executive order?
The government that is formed after this.
But with in the presence, so the new prime minister could execute that order.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you see it coming from the new prime minister.
Has to pass an order. That's all.
So it's coming from the new prime minister. There will not need to be an independent legislative action of any kind.
No, it's not to be legislative.
All right,
executive act would be enough.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to ask about October of last year, as was mentioned. I'm Alan Kronstadt from Congressional Research Service. You mentioned, sir, that any employee of Pakistan has to leave a position for 2 years before being eligible. I've also noted that the Constitution requires members of the armed services to take an oath that they won't participate in politics. So as a non-lawyer, it looked fairly straightforward, the situation. But on, I believe, October 5th, the Supreme Court ruled that the presidential election, the planned presidential election, could take place, that they would reserve or withhold judgment till a later date. So during that month of October, from what I saw, there was an overwhelming consensus that the court was unlikely to undo the verdict. And then in the very last days of October, there popped up some reports that this court was about to overturn that election or find it unconstitutional. And then a couple days later, of course, the emergency was imposed. Can you shed some light on that? What was it true that the court was leaning toward validating the election at one time?
Yeah, let me ask. I was a counsel in this case. To begin with, when I argued the injunction, I did not get the injunction which I was seeking. That was stop the poll, because we thought that outgoing assemblies and outgoing electoral college cannot elect an incoming president, which is a very simple democratic proposition. On the question whether he was eligible to run, the Constitution was very clear. It says that any person in the service of Pakistan, whether civil service or a military service, is not qualified to run for the office of president. The other provision which Mr. Hamid had pointed out was that even if he had decided to resign the day before and say, now I can run, he could not. Because another provision says that if you quit the service of Pakistan, you must wait 2 years before you can participate in the election. The other thing which you have very rightly pointed out, the oath of the military officials is very clearly said that I will not take part in politics. So therefore, when he was chief of army staff, he was bound by that oath. Now, coming on the practicalities of the thing that you have pointed out, and I must appreciate that you're following the scene over there in those days, that on the 5th, we did not get the completely that order. Order was on the 5th that, yes, let the poll go ahead, but you will not notify the results. This was the order, till the decision of the court. So when the main petition was argued from 17th October onward, we honestly did not know. Even today, I will not be able to say that till 2nd of November, myself and the other main counsel in this case ever thought that we are going to win the case. We have been discussing it on day-to-day basis, that how do you count the... we said 4 are definitely against us out of 11. We were quite clear. But how many more they will be able to take away was always a question. We always feared that maybe a fifth one whose remarks were not very favorable. So that was hanging around 1 or 2 votes this way or that way. This seemed to be the state of things as we could make out from the comments that we were getting, responses we were getting, questions we were receiving, answers we were making, or the government lawyers were making. Perhaps Musharraf had better information, because those Johnnies, 4 of them, who later took oath under PCO, were also sitting over there. They were rather informers. Some of them, we have always thought and suspected, are informers and are connected to the intelligence agencies. Maybe around the 2nd of November, some discussions took place inside, because hardly 2 or 3 days of hearing was left. The Attorney General had concluded, Mr. Pirzada had to argue for half a day, and we would have replied one day, and that's all by the sixth or seventh latest, the arguments would have concluded and their verdict would have come. It seems around 2nd, there was some information coming from inside the discussions of the judges that they perceived that they are going, 7 are going to go against them. The only way now this stands confirmed is what happened 3rd of November, because 7 out of 11 judges did not take oath under the PCO, 4 did. It means the split was favorable to us by 7-4 around that time. And that is why he got so desperate that he virtually destroyed the Constitution, mutilated the Constitution, destroyed our judiciary just to save his skin, that he may not be declared disqualified.
Mark Schneider, International Crisis Group. I'm curious about 2 things. One is the government has not yet been formed. We're still waiting to see the final results and the negotiation on the coalition. The demonstrations of lawyers continues. I was curious as to why you would not want to wait until the new government is formed in terms of determining whether or not to continue the demonstrations or not. And the second is that you mentioned just the issue of the acts that he took on November 3rd, but during the emergency rule period, there were a series of ordinances that he also enunciated, and when he actually lifted emergency rule, he also, the evening earlier, enacted again another series of constitutional amendments. Would they also fall on the basis of an executive order that would essentially implement the decision that was taken by the 7 Supreme Court justices? And if so, is there likely to be a constitutional challenge for that executive order from the current sitting court? And if there is, what would the military do?
The first question was, why are we still continuing our protests, despite the fact that there is still a caretaker government? In the first place, we are seeing from day to day what is going on. We see that Musharraf, who has lost the who has been badly defeated and rejected, continues to hang on to the power and wants to hang on for another many years. And we are also seeing that he is trying to manipulate the political scene by trying to get together, put together a coalition favorable to him, who is ready to make a deal with him to retain him as president and to give him more powers than a president and a parliamentary system should have. So we are seeing all that happening before us, a drama. We are also seeing that the Bush administration is backing him, and there is a frequent interference by the U.S. ambassador in Islamabad, by Mr. Boucher, by Madam Rice making statements. All that is going on. So we see what is cooking over there. And we know that the what is being done is to defeat the mandate of the people of Pakistan that the parties got on the 18th of February. So therefore, we have to keep ourselves ready to fight out the situation that may end up after all these interference and manipulations. So we know that we must keep on fighting. As long as Musharraf is there, there can be no justice for the judges, there can be no justice for the country. So that's one reason why we'll continue our protest till our position is vindicated. Secondly, the post-November 3, yes, he says he imposed the emergency and PCO and oath of office order, these three main instruments, on 3rd of November. Rest of them were actually based upon what was done on 3rd of November. The basic documents were came in 3rd of November, and the remaining documents which came about after that, amendments in the ordinances, amendments in the constitution, amendment, and the finally a validation clause by way of Article 270AAA saying whatever I have done from 3rd of November, all is validated. I'm fine. Don't look at me. I'm indemnified. I stand cleared. The Constitution stands amended. Everything is fine, whatever I have done. The question is, all that is based upon the structure that was, or the illegal structure that he built on the 3rd of November. If that stands nullified by the order of the Supreme Court, the rest of the structure built upon it will certainly collapse, will not stand in the air. So therefore, we believe that that structure, which has been undone through an injunction and through a declaration on 3rd of November, would be sufficient to undo all the subsequent acts based on them.
You were the first guy up, so why don't we start with, why don't we let this gentleman here go first, just because he had his hand up at the very beginning.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. The extremists may not have done well in the elections, but they don't seem to care. What has happened this past week? Bombing in Rawalpindi killed a general about a week ago. Bombing over the weekend killed 40 people in the Peace Jirga. Bombing just this morning, when I saw the news in Lahore, I believe, killed several people. Let us say the United States does back you instead of Musharraf. What do you do to deal with this threat?
My answer will be counter question. What has Bush done to undo that? He's still in control of things. The power has not been transferred. It is under his nose all that is going on. So therefore, it is he who has failed to curb this. Let's not first put any prior blame to those who may take over power from him in a matter of a few days. But let's see his performance. Let's look at that. We are facing terrorism. Pakistan is a victim of terrorism. One of the reasons why people voted against him on 18th of February, because he has failed to protect people from terrorism. So therefore, now he has to go. He has failed. He has not been able to deliver. So let's keep that in mind. These incidents only speak against him, not in his favor. He cannot use these incidents to say that, look here, if I go, what will happen?
I think let's accept, for the questioner's sake, let's accept that he leaves and you are in charge. What do you do? That's, I think, the question that he's asking.
Now, there are two aspects to it, which I must clear. That's why I said the main important thing is to separate the political power from what is required to be done militarily. We are not saying that don't hold military operation against terrorists. This is not what Pakistanis are saying. We are ready. If you can, where you can make a political settlement, by all means do it. Where political settlement, but the power to decide should be in the hands of political parties, elected representatives, not in the hands of a military dictator. It should be in their hand to decide where, what terrorism has to be met with what kind of a response, political or military. Let them decide that. Let them give them a chance to decide to meet this challenge. It is not necessary the response which Musharraf has done to these incidents would be the right response. Maybe the political parties and the representatives may be able to come up with better response. Of course, we agree that there should be done something effectively against terrorism, but terrorism should not be made the basis for somebody to continue in political power.
This, the gentleman who had the microphone here before that we so rudely took away.
No problem, no. My name is Aaron Zisser. I'm with Human Rights First. I just wanted to get your insight about, and I spoke with both of you about this yesterday, but I was hoping you could illuminate the rest of the audience and maybe get into some more detail. A couple weeks ago, there was a report that nobody really paid much attention to in the McClatchy Newswire that reported that U.S. officials, unnamed U.S. officials, were actually actively pressuring the new Pakistani leadership to stop calling for reinstatement of the judiciary, as opposed to just being silent on the matter. Senator Feingold referred to this report vaguely in a question he posed to Deputy Secretary of State Negroponte on Thursday's hearing in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The Dawn newspaper very responsibly picked up that question and, again, vaguely referred to that report. But generally, it's been ignored. And I know that you both have been meeting with State Department officials in your visit here, as well as on the Hill. And I was wondering if you could shed any further light on those reports or on State Department's response to the accusation levied in that report. And also just your impression in terms of how that whether that represents a shift in U.S. policy, probably for the worse. Thanks.
Yes, actually, we have been getting such mixed reports. Sometimes, particularly coming from more knowledgeable sources in USA, like Senator Joe Biden. What he has been saying over the last few months, we think makes a lot of sense, and we think he understands the realities, political as well as other within Pakistan, and I think he has better solutions to offer than the Bush administration. When he particularly said that the U.S. aid should be spent on the development of Pakistan and providing social services to Pakistan rather than making few military generals happy and line their pockets. I think he is hitting the nail on the head. This is where things should go, where the priorities should be. You should try to do things for the people of Pakistan so that they feel that U.S. Administration is doing something for them rather than feel that they are having a special relationship with a class of people over there who are not responsible to them. So that is one aspect. Whenever we hear anything from, or there are reports coming from the State Department, from people like Mr. Boucher or Mr. Negroponte, we find that what the independent sources or think tanks in USA are considering or advising is not being taken by the State Department. The State Department appears to put all its eggs in one basket, Musharraf's basket. So they think that he is the man who is best for them to deal, and the unknowns are unknowns for them. They are not ready to go into that area. And I think that's where the policy needs to be reversed. Seems to be that they are still sticking to that policy, and they think that this is the wisest course to take. And in any case, any change of policy will wait for another substantial time. And we have very little time on that. So we hope the sane voices on foreign policy are listened.
Could I sharpen the question a little bit here? Do you have evidence or have you heard directly of evidence that the United States ambassador or embassy is discouraging the restoration of the judges? I think that was the question that was asked.
Two or three clear evidence on that. When Benazir Bhutto was still alive, she made a statement that she wants, she will be restoring the judiciary. This appeared in all the newspapers in Pakistan. She went to the house of the Chief Justice. She was prevented from going and seeing him. But he made a statement when there were barricades that she accepts him as the Chief Justice, and he had brought flowers, rather a bouquet, to give to the Chief Justice, who is our real Chief Justice. That was the position he had taken. Next day, Mr. Negroponte visited Pakistan. It was reported in the press he met Musharraf, and he had a telephone talk with Benazir Bhutto because she was in Karachi. And she changed her position immediately on judges next day. She started saying things, ambivalent things. We don't know. Judges come and judges go. It's not a question of restoration. It is a question of independence. All that kind of a big stuff. She started talking. So what should we conclude? Is the Negroponte's telephone call that changed her stance, because she wants to keep American administration pleased. Second, only recently after the elections, Mr. Nawaz Sharif and Mr. Zardari met and addressed a press conference, and we said that we are at one on the issue of restoration of judiciary. We felt very happy about it. Next day, or the day after, he goes to the U.S. embassy, stays there for three hours, and comes back and become vague on this issue, and say, we'll sit down and talk. We'll see when the parliament assembles. We'll consider this. This is a kind of complicated thing. When Mr. Itzaz talked to him immediately after this his visit, they had a sort of argument. He said, why are you being vague? Why don't you say what you have said only 2 days earlier? But this, what does this show to us? That this is the stance of the U.S. administration is adverse to the restoration of judges.
One question, and that is, if the prime minister, the new prime minister, comes down with the executive order that you suggested, and it's not, and President Musharraf does not respond to it, then what? How is that constitutional crisis resolved?
I would agree with you. Constitutional crisis will only be resolved when we see the back of Musharraf. He will always create all kind of constitutional crisis, because a man who believes in force and not in reason will always create situation to perpetuate himself. Yes, there will be a constitutional crisis, and again, but I would tell you, the people will stand behind, the whole entire population of Pakistan will stand behind that executive order of the Prime Minister, and he will have really difficulty to fight it out unless some greater force is lent to him to ensure that he can again get away with an unconstitutional act. But otherwise, this will be one of the most popular things that can be done, which will be popular with the people of Pakistan.
Okay, let's try this side of the room here.
Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association. A president, whether civilian or otherwise, is the supreme commander of the armed forces. Now, you say he is not the president as per the Constitution. Can General Kiani and his colleagues, who the chief of staff of other services, can refuse to obey him?
Well, let me say that he should not be president. And if he is not president, anybody should not obey him. I have no duty to obey him. I don't think so. He has been elected constitutionally. But you see, I would rather keep the armed forces out of politics. Because the problem with Musharraf is he got politics terribly mixed with the military. And that's your question itself shows that there are time and again questions that arise which mix the military with politics in a very bad way. And so we want to avoid that. That's why he should be out of the way, so that this kind of a situation may not arise. We will not like a fight between the president and the armed forces, provided the president is legitimately elected. So, and if he's legitimately elected, then there's really no such point. Besides, the president in a parliamentary system may be called as as the supreme commander, but you know better than me. In India, the president is technically the supreme commander because he is head of the state. In that capacity, he is ex officio the commander. But does he ever issue a command to the armed forces or to a chief of army staff or chief of naval staff or chief of air staff? He never does it. It is not the function of a president in a parliament system to issue orders to the military. It is the federal government, or in India, what they call a central government, that union government that does it. So let's be clear the scheme of things as they should be in a parliamentary setup.
Tahir Andrabi, Georgetown University. Sir, my question, in Pakistan, one often hears terms like extra-constitutional, supra-constitutional, constitution held in abeyance. Are these terms strictly the propriety, copyright of Pakistan political leadership, or do these terms have some presence in law books elsewhere? And with reference to these terms, and particularly the post-November 3 situation, what do you see the scope of Article 6 of the Pakistan Constitution?
Thank you. Yeah, in the first place, I must say that Pakistan is greatly responsible for coining such terms, and our judiciary has done well in doing that because it keeps justifying extra-constitutional, unconstitutional, supra-constitutional acts of the military dictators. So therefore, they had to find ways and means to coin these terms in the first place and then to use it. Anyway, they are particularly relevant to Pakistan. However, we do export such concepts to countries like Burma and others. So for that matter, we can even have a copyright on these terms. Anybody who wants to use these things, terms should also pay some money to us for initiating in the first place. We are the first country to use the Kelsen's theory the wrong way. And then one of the African countries borrowed that from us. So there can be. We have setting good precedents for military dictators all over the world, how to go about it. And one of our legal experts in Pakistan who has been doing all that for the years, he was the first person to be selected by all military dictators to become the legal advisor. And this time somebody asked him, and that, why did you get this notorious man again, Saifuddin Pirzada, to advise you? Musharraf said that, listen, I had no choice. Somebody told me that he is the best man to keep you out of the legal minds. he tells you how to get out of the legal mind fields. And these are the terms that he can use to keep the military dictators out of the constitutional landmines. So that was for the first part of your question. Now, the second part of your question has been about Article 6. This is something, the long-standing demand of the lawyers, that one day we must punish, we must try a military ruler under Article 6 for high treason, for abrogating or subverting the Constitution. This is a dream we have. We hope someday we can make it a reality, because that is the one which will stop the military intervention for good. Because we have seen, we have an examples, like for example South Korea, the day they tried those journals, Chun and Ru and those people, there has not been any military intervention, and now their democracy is functional. Even Bangladesh, the day they caught Irshad and punished him, since then, though Bangladesh has a lot of political instability, no military adventurers had the guts to come forward and assume the political office. So we think that is a panacea for getting rid of dictatorship forever. But we have a difficulty. That difficulty arises out of our military having special relationship with the US administrations. And that's the backing they get. If minus that backing, we will deal with the Musharraf and we can try him and punish him. But what do we do when he is backed by very powerful external forces?
This gentleman in the back.
Shahid Buttar, Pakistan Justice Coalition. I have a multi-part question and I'll keep it to a minute. First, with respect to the elections, you discussed a number of problems plaguing the elections despite the reports of their relative legitimacy, at least relative to the expectations of overt rigging. Had the elections actually been fair, to what extent would the opposition parties have the supermajority in the National Assembly that they would need to on their own accord, remove Musharraf even without the executive order that you describe. Second, to what extent does the alignment of parties who came out ahead in that election, particularly the PMLN and its platform, and especially taken in account with the parties that boycotted the election, the APDM, is there any sort of popular mandate with respect to the judges that we can infer from the election? And then second, you mentioned that Pakistan is, in tongue-in-cheek, is setting good precedents for other military dictators. Do you think that those precedents might extend to the lessons that military dictators draw with respect to how to gain support from Washington? And do you think that that lesson is one that might come back to haunt the United States in any other number of contexts?
Yes. In the first place, these elections even were thoroughly rigged. There's no doubt about it. And it would have produced much different and much better results had there not been this miscounting of votes and interference that had happened. Right now, the three major parties in the opposition who have anti-Musharraf parties, they stand at around 155 to 160 seats out of 268 that were contested. That does not make two-thirds majority. Had there been no manipulation on the part of Musharraf, they would easily achieve, because at least there are 30 seats in the National Assemblies which can come to the coalition of parties. But those are the ones which is always used by the military establishment in Pakistan to play their game. And he is playing with those 30, 40 independents so that they do not have two-thirds majority to impeach him. And this is these are the ones which are used as pawns in his game of power. And that is what is making us feel very upset about it. Then secondly, he wants to break between these parties. And he's using America for that purpose. He's that the Americans will not let you have power unless you do this. This is the message he keeps giving them. And some of the parties are ready to buy that message. And some of the parties think that have whatever little power you can get, rather than not getting power at all. They know the 1971 scenario where a military dictator deprived a party which had won the election from forming the government, which resulted ultimately, unfortunately, in the break of Pakistan. But there is an example where a military ruler can keep the popular party out of power. And this is what is in the psyche of many political parties in Pakistan, that they can do this. What would stop them from doing such a mad or outrageous thing? So therefore, he is using the holding of power. That's why he's delaying. He delayed the announcement of results. He is not delaying the calling of the parliament, because before he calls the parliament to session for electing the prime minister, he will like to have a deal fully sewed up in his own favor. And that is where things are. And to which we believe and we perceive that the Bush administration is lending a helping hand. Had that helping hand not been there, he would not be able to manipulate political parties. What your second question was? Yes, naturally, because the lesson, as it appears to happen in both cases of Ziaul-Haq and Musharraf, if you happen to become a frontline state, if you have a difficult geopolitical geographical situation, then you are going to benefit if you take power by any means. And if you take power, the Americans are going to do business with you and perpetuate you in power. So that is a very unfortunate example. Well, they may not do it with Uruguay, or they may not do it with some such country, the military dictator whom they don't want to use for any of their larger global purposes. But any other country coming into the same situation can have a military adventure gained from close relationship with the U.S., who will prop a dictator against a messy democracy.
Thank you. Tawqeer Hussain, I'm a former Pakistani ambassador and now teaching at Georgetown. Thank you so much. Both of you spoke well, and in answering our questions, you helped clarify a lot of issues. And in the same spirit, I'm asking two questions, not to put you on the spot, but to get some candid and honest answers, and just make one comment also. Question about, you said United States needs to relate to the people, and I agree with you entirely. I think one of the serious problems United States has had, not only with Pakistan, but anywhere else, fighting unpopular causes through unpopular leaderships. And that's happening in Pakistan also, which has alienated both the United States and the leadership through which it has worked. And it needs to reverse that policy. Now, how does United States relate to people? What exactly is required to be done? I mean, which will please people, which will satisfy them, which will restore their confidence in the relationship with the U.S., which will restore their trust in the U.S. intentions? And is it a question of aid? Is it a question of some other support, some other way? Is it a question of doing something and not doing something? For example, war on terrorism. I know Pakistanis are not happy with many of its aspects, and similarly, America is not happy with many of the things that Pakistan is doing and not doing on the war on terrorism. I think that's going to be a moot point, critical point, even if Musharraf goes, and I'm sure he will. I mean, his days are numbered. I don't think he will stay on, certainly not in this position. He may stay on in some other reduced position. But this is going to be a major issue, so I would like to hear your answer on that. And second question was, when politicians and the lawyers seek the restoration of the Constitution, usually the date that is mentioned is 12th October 1999, that Constitution as it existed before. And my reading of the political situation is that the Constitution since 1973 has been successively and consistently mutilated and brutalized by different governments. So why don't you ask for restoration of the 1973 Constitution? What's the problem in that? Two questions, and I want your honest answer. But just before I, one short comment on the issue that you have now dwelt a great deal on, U.S. support from Musharraf. I personally feel, correct me if I'm wrong, that U.S. is calculating that perhaps the balance of power is still slightly in his favor, because the major party, the leading party, which has won the election, which has been in negotiations for deal with Musharraf for so long with the help of the United States and Britain, its own position is very ambivalent on where they stand vis-a-vis Musharraf. So I personally feel perhaps they are letting the politics take its course and rather than sort of withdraw their support from Musharraf. But let's see, maybe PPP itself may have different, may come to the same conclusion as the United States. Thank you.
The first question was regarding in what way you think that the United States can help, help and can get, create a positive impression on the people of Pakistan. You see, the thing is, something can be done by acts and some can be done by omissions. By X I mean that if you're giving aid, give aid for developing the social services in Pakistan and giving a helping hand in the development of the infrastructure of Pakistan. Because these two things will be seen very visibly and very tangibly by the people of Pakistan coming from the United States. So therefore, that such acts, positive acts of providing for that. Another thing that can be done, though not tangibly, less tangible thing, is by supporting the democratic institutions develop in Pakistan. And the first step now available to them is support the restoration of judiciary. This is an act which would strengthen democracy in Pakistan by having an independent judiciary, by having some accountability of our rulers who spent mercilessly without authorization. So that is one thing that it can immediately do to win the hearts and minds of the people. That's, look here, our main demand is now backed by the U.S. administration, and that will have a very, very positive effect for making Pakistan, for making U.S. administration, people feeling positively and towards the U.S. administration. Similarly, there will be other hiccups in which the democracy will be tried to be saved by our undemocratic forces. There, if U.S. stands by the democratic forces against undemocratic forces, the impression will prevail that America is really promoting democracy, not just paying lip service to it, as the Bush administration has been doing for the last 7 years. So there is so much to do. What would be by way of omission? By not forcing on Pakistan things which are not good for its development. For example, I take one example. You are well aware that the project of Iranian gas and oil is waiting for a long time. India wants the gas, wants oil from Iran. Pakistan would be the conduit through which the pipeline will pass and will also be beneficiary. We are deficient in power, deficient in an energy right now. We are in a very bad shape. But for the last 6 or 7 years, this project has been frustrated by the interference of the U.S. administration. So therefore, even India could not benefit. It is short of energy. Pakistan could not benefit from if it stays its hands off these such projects, only because Iran is involved in that. This would help create a better feeling towards the United States by omitting not to obstruct its developmental project. Now, perception is widespread. We are not getting oil because America doesn't want that oil pipeline to be laid through Pakistan and to be given to and provided to India. They say that our development, because by our own estimation, that oil pipeline will contribute $4 billion to the annual revenue of Pakistan, more than what American aid would be. So by stopping that project, Pakistan is suffering by every day. So there are so many. I just give generally examples, positive as well as negative, to promote a goodwill in Pakistan and to help Pakistan go over its economic and social problems. The second question of yours was? Yeah, you said. Is the major issue, the terrorism is something which is our issue. The sooner the military rulers removed from the scene and the matter is handled by our elected representatives, at least people start seeing the problem of terrorism in a different context. It will be seen as if it is our problem, and our representatives should do something about it. Use some political leverage somewhere, use some force at another place. You do it your way. You do it your way. Right now, the predominant impression or perception of Pakistan is that this is a war of American interests, not ours, though we are the victims of that. We are the primary victims of the terrorism there. But somehow, because of Musharraf, who is seen as a toady of U.S. administration, we see things, Pakistani sees things that this is not our war. He is engaged ourselves in this war. But sooner he removes, we will see the whole problem in its correct dimensions and its correct perspective. That needs to be done. And the solution to terrorism is to be found within Pakistan, not from outside Pakistan. Whether this is done by a political, that should primarily done by a civilian leadership with the naturally help and under their orders by the military if need be. But not on the dictation from outside how this problem has to be resolved, because that is claiming more lives in Pakistan. That was one part of the question. The second part of the question was? Yeah. Now, that is quite a... You're right. Our first demand has always been, and even now, that let's restore the Constitution as it stood on October 12, 1999. Because that was the right version of the Constitution, because what was... many of the tampering done during Zia-ul Haq's time had been corrected in 1997 by 13th and 14th Amendment. So we believe right now the version of the Constitution as it was on 12th of October is the best version that we can have prior to the Musharraf. As a second position, we say that even 2nd November thing would also be acceptable, because most of the tampering done in the Constitution through 17th Amendment and his LFO had expired by 15th of November. That was basically meant to secure him in the office of president till 15th of November. That time is passed. So therefore, those amendments, though they are written down in the Constitution, but are no longer effective and active. So we can live with the Constitution of 2nd of November. And of course, then we will seek some constitutional reforms in it. We want to get started from here. We are not saying that this is the final objective. This is the base from where we want to build our constitutional dispensation.
Did that answer your question? Was there something in the 1973 Constitution that is missing in the 1999? No, you're okay with that? Okay. Well, that you've left open an entire area of intellectual inquiry for us to pursue here. Let's do two more questions from this. Well, can we do a quick round? Can you just quick answers to these questions? We'll do all four of these if we have them. If you could just, why don't you fire, let's fire up the four questions, and then could you write down these questions? I'm just going to ask them one after another, and then you have to answer them all. Okay? Please, right there in the center.
No, Simons, Council on Foreign Relations. I wanted to ask how you foresee the lawyers' movement moving forward if the new government does not, in fact, restore the November 2nd judiciary and constitution, given that even though you allege that a lot of rigging did occur in the recent elections, it seems that the Pakistani people have largely deemed them credible, and therefore there might not be the same popular mobilization on behalf of the lawyers' movement that we saw between March and July of last year.
Good, thank you. Why don't we go ahead right there, sure.
Hi, Melanie Pizer, independent consultant. You talked, intimated that perhaps some of the judicial decisions over the years haven't been the greatest, and also that one of the things the U.S. could do would be to support institution building and a democratic judicial institution. What actually needs to change within the judiciary should the best case scenario happen and everything is restored? And what can the U.S. do to support that?
Good questions, yes.
My name is Narjis Ali, and I'm with the Pakistan Movement for Justice, too. I wanted to ask something specific to a region in Pakistan, which is Balochistan. Balochistan's sort of been the victim of this government, and yet we see that the most popular, you know, seats were won in that province. They've got, I don't know, about 27 seats or something in Balochistan. And looking at the lawyers' movement, how is that working in Balochistan, or are there any lawyers from Balochistan that are actively taking part in that? And I mean, obviously the rigging must have gone on massively in that province, despite the fact that that province has really been hit by everything that Musharraf's regime did.
Thank you.
I think there's one last question here in the first row. Are you all set? Okay, so what? Okay, well, let's see how good these answers are, and then we'll come maybe give you another shot. Okay, we have one possible last question.
You see, first question was, what happens to the lawyers' movement if judiciary is not restored? Am I correct?
Yes.
That was the question. Yes. The lawyers' movement will continue till the restoration of judiciary, and we have no means of giving up on this issue. And we think that we have sufficient political support and support of the people of Pakistan on this issue, and therefore we'll give it our best shot. And we are ready for long, drawn-out battle on this. And we feel that whatever the civilian government may do, it will face very great difficulty facing the lawyers with political support, particularly the judges, popular judges, and the Chief Justice, who have so much of support of the common man in Pakistan. We think we can pursue this to a point of success.
But what about mass demonstrations? I mean, to this point, the lawyers' movement has been mostly the lawyers. It hasn't had, even though you mentioned the broad political support, which I think a lot is accepted, there hasn't been really the large street demonstrations. And there seems to be a discussion within the movement, the lawyer movement, of whether it should go in that direction. What do you see?
Earlier there
a change was, in your tactics or not, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, but because you will find that there was reason why there was not so much political parties coming out with us, though they were with so many of them are with us, coming out with us on the streets, and that many people observed that perhaps there is a support dwindling because of don't see so many political workers and civil society members out there. Actually, in the last 3 months, they kept them somehow involved in the elections, and elections, political parties were deeply involved in the elections, so therefore their worker was not free to come and stand by us and take participate in our processions. Things will certainly change for the better. Those political parties that support us, whether this is Nawaz League, whether it's APDM, now they have no other engagement but to support the avowed object for which they have either not participated in the election or participated in the election. So there is a certain amount of political support which has been demonstrated by the people. The other thing is how long they can keep the Chief Justice confined. The day Chief Justice comes out, there will be a very, very different kind of a response which you'll see in the country. He's so so popular. We've already noticed from March to July the way we were received everywhere with the way Chief Justice. He is the most popular man in Pakistan right now. Nobody stands near him in popularity. So therefore, the reason why they are keeping him under such stringent restraints or confinement is that they know what he means for the people of Pakistan. So therefore, that when that step takes place, once he comes out, even if he doesn't go to the public to deliver public speeches, we take him to the Bar Association to deliver speeches, still we will have to travel many miles. And the outpouring of support will be overwhelming. And I think we wish that before that has to be done, they restore the judiciary. If anybody understands the implications, they should know that things should not be brought to that end, that we have to take him out on the roads from city to city, and the whole situation comes to a standstill. So intelligent political leaders should know better than that. Now that is about the restoration. The second question was,
if the judiciary had flaws in it beforehand, which most people seem to think was the case, what could be done, and how could the United States help to clean up the judiciary?
You see, the thing is, in the first place, we are not saying the restoration of judiciary is the ultimate object. This is a first step towards independence of judiciary. This is what we said. We made public announcement when the Chief Justice was restored. Don't say the judiciary is independent. We say we have taken the first step towards that. Now, if judges are restored, that will be a very major step towards independence of judiciary. But still, it's not going to be free of scoundrels. It's not free of persons who are ready to pander to the military rulers or to the establishment. Still, lot of reforms have to come. We have an agenda of reforms. We have already submitted reports for constitutional amendments to improve the functioning of the judiciary and election commission, to ensure its neutrality, to ensure that these become independent institutions, to ensure that better selection methods are adopted. We have already, from lawyers, we have, and with political parties, agreed to certain measures, which includes the creation of a judicial commission in which the lawyers, the parliamentarian, and the judges will participate for better selection of judges and for better proceedings, process for their removal in case they are not up to the mark. So that is, we have an agenda after that, but it only begins after this restoration takes place. The third question was about lawyers' movement in Balochistan. Right? What Balochistan has suffered in last years the most, because there has been complete oppression, military. Now let's see, the military operations that took place in Balochistan has nothing to do with terrorism. It had everything to do with the political opposition, because he wanted to set some of the tribal leaders right, who were not in favor of. You will be surprised to find when we sit in the APDM meetings, the Balochistan and frontier thinks very differently. Their political leaders within our setup thinks differently. When we try to address that the military operations should stop in NWF and Balochistan, the Baloch leaders generally say yes in Balochistan, but not in NWFP. This is what they say. Why? You must confine that military operations should continue, but only against outsiders. There is a clear perception of Baloch people. They are basically opposed to religious activism, and they want a secular setup in Balochistan, and they realize that this military operation is against their rights, against their constitutional aspirations, whereas that one has some justification in it. So these are the various perceptions that are prevailing. Now, what a lawyers' movement? Incidentally, in lawyers' movement, there is absolutely no difference between any provinces. I think we are a very strong federation of lawyers. some of our leaders of the are from Balochistan. For example, Ali Ahmed Kurd has become very distinguished in this. He belongs to Balochistan. Mr. Tariq Mahmood, another one of us five lawyers of Chief Justice. He is also drawn from Balochistan. He had been a judge of the Balochistan High Court. And Iftikhar Muhammad Chaudhry himself, the Chief Justice, comes from Balochistan. And he is the most popular man in Pakistan. So therefore, lawyers' movement in Balochistan is the same as it is in Punjab or in NWFP or in Sindh. Oh, yes. Actually, some seats that have been won by PMLQ in Balochistan is due to the void left by APDM. You know, APDM has contains all the nationalist parties of Balochistan, which have boycotted the election. Therefore, the elections in Balochistan have not been the elections as in other provinces, because very low turnout in Balochistan, and people did not take interest. APDM had asked them to boycott. So therefore, if you have figures of the number of votes cast in Balochistan, they are far less than cast in the other provinces. Those elections are not credible and legitimate. Yeah, they use the void because nobody was contesting. They put in a candidate who was elected after a very small turnover.
Thank you very much. I think before we give an ovation to our two guests, I'd like to thank our generous donors that make these programs possible: Plowshares Fund, the Soros, and Carnegie Corporation of New York. They've all been very supportive of these discussions, and we'd like to thank them as well. And also for those of you who have friends who could not make it here today or would like to revisit part of this program, there will be a recording of it and a podcast available within the next day or so on the CSIS website. So please, we recommend that. And you can always come to our blog, pcrproject.com, if you want to get any of this information faster. So again, please join me in thanking our two guests for their presentations.